This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the NeuroNoodle Network Podcast News and Notes Edition. I'm Pete Janssens, and alongside me will be Anthony Ramos. He's a passionate enthusiast and connoisseur of technology content in the realms of mental health and well-being. In our show, we delve into the latest news, innovative research, and emerging trends in neuroscience and mental health. Anthony brings a fresh perspective as a dedicated follower and fan, sharing insights and reflections on our past NeuroNoodle Podcast episodes, as well as his take on the latest developments in the field. Whether you're a professional, a student, or simply someone fascinated by mental health and neuroscience, join us as we explore these topics in a format that's informative, engaging, and accessible to all. So without further ado, let's dive into what's new and noteworthy in the world of mental health and neuroscience and just plain old technology. Let's hear Anthony's thoughts on our previous discussions and current trends. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration through polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Stuff that we have going on for a new idea.
So what is this? How do we get to this group, Anthony? Is this on Facebook?
Yeah, probably. So it's called Science and Technology Discoveries, and I've been running this for like probably 10 years, a little more. You can search for Science and Technology Discoveries on Facebook, but you could also try typing in facebook.com/Tony O. Ramos, which is just my kind of my name, facebook.com/Tony O. Ramos. And right at the top in my about, I say, join my science and technology group. So, so I thought we'd dive in. You know, this weekend I saw a cool movie. I don't know if you guys are in the movies, but it relates to the news with what's going on with psychedelics and depression treatment a little bit. The Dune movie that came out, which is a big movie, there's a lot of psychology. If anybody goes sees it in the, it's called Jungian psychology, Jung, the psychologist. And he meets a lot of figures who represent Jungian archetypes, and like the mother, the father, the shadow, the trickster. These represents, Jung said that this represents sides of our subconscious, and that the subconscious talks to us in dreams. Well, the character in the movie takes this psychedelic spice, and the book comes out of the 50s and 60s, when we were just becoming exposed to psychedelics, or they were known to us, and they allow his dreams to be waking dreams, and they give him special knowledge. Well, that's kind of like what people describe psychedelics to really be like, is that they have these trips and they're healing, they're therapeutic. And so just yesterday, actually, a study came out I have here from CNN. A single dose of LSD provides immediate lasting anxiety relief. And they said they had a 48% remission rate, which, by the way, if you saw Martine Arnn's presentation or heard us talking about it on stratified psychiatry using EEG biomarkers, 50% is about what you can expect from most depression treatments, including antidepressants, therapy, TMS, ketamine, which is a psychedelic. And then they also had 65% of people improved up to 3 months later, and that's just when they stopped testing. So seems like there's some good stuff out there. Jay has spoken about psychedelics, said very interesting, helpful things, such as that I recall from your podcast. Psychedelics are best for people that have the midline frontal theta brainwave. And it's really interesting that that is the one that they have the most, that's the group that has the most benefit, according to Jay, because that brainwave in general is associated with mystical experiences. It's associated with prayer, dreaming. So remember the dreams, the subconscious may be talking to us through dreams, and even susceptibility to hypnosis. And one of the reasons that they said that those folks with the midline frontal theta are so good at hypnosis, the researchers in that study, they said, we believe that it gives them an enhanced ability to focus. So they're able to focus on the commands from the hypnotist and kind of shut everything out. So it's pretty interesting stuff. And then the last thing, interestingly, and I'll have a chance to talk about this, but people with frontal theta in one study, those were found to be the best responders to therapy, talk therapy. So our EEG can even predict how you're going to respond to traditional, you know, non-drug or non-neurofeedback even. So just wanted to bring all that into focus with this one psychedelic story.
Now, what are the people commenting on? Like, what's giving you a lift in there? It could be an old post or whatever, but like, what are people really responding to?
So I actually don't really focus on engagement, if that sounds weird. You do get people asking questions. I think if it's something that's either controversial or essential to their life. So if it's advice of like, I'm making it up, but run 50 minutes a day to feel healthier. And they'll say, well, maybe how fast do I need to run? And if it's something saying like, doctors are saying that, running is no longer the best treatment for your heart or something. If it's something controversial, you'll hear that too. Mm-hmm. Facebook can be a little bit of a madhouse sometimes. So there's a lot of people that try to post in the group that are just trying to spam or post. Honestly, the weirdest one is I get a lot of people trying to post their science projects. So I literally have thousands of people in my post approvals that are asking me to let them post a super like specific esoteric present. I can only think it was like their classroom college experiment.
Right, right.
That's the group. Yeah.
All right.
So when we can talk, if you ever want to hear more, feel free to
reach out. I'm just trying to let people know about the group. Like we're trying to focus on, you know, what's trending. So I'm trying to get a gauge what's trending, like what's making you post in this group? It captures your interest, but how does it get to you posting there?
I started this when Facebook groups first came out, that like the month they came out. And it just seemed to me, I was posting this stuff already. I said, it'd be nice to have a group.
Okay.
And at one point I was getting like 30 or 40 people signing up a day, but it became such investment of time at that point that I said, let me relax on this. And I wasn't able to get that momentum going again. But I do find it's useful. I get people, you know, I hear people that appreciate it, and it's useful to me as like cataloging things. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the best group for clinicians that I see to kind of learn things, discuss is maybe the Brain Master group. There's another one that's like QEEG clinicians consultation group that I think my friend Jay Gaddis runs. Mm-hmm. He works for the Almond Clinics.
Right.
And then I also like, there's a group on Facebook called Neurofeedback Exchange, and a group called neurofeedback community, those are good. I'm more in the exchange and in the Brain Master group, but they're all useful. I think Lisa Tartarin runs, it feels like she probably runs neurofeedback therapy and advocacy, I think is the name. So that's probably another one to get good university research posted in. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
All right, what else we got in there?
Yeah, so this was from a few weeks ago. This is about the sleep spindle in people with PTSD. So I wanted to talk to you all. I had some questions about, people were asking me, well, what did you do for sleep? And traditionally, SMR is the neurofeedback for sleep. And as you know, SMR neurofeedback, Jay will tell you, it's what you're training is the sleep spindle. And the sleep spindle is a brainwave that fires to prevent someone from waking up. So it is helpful in deep sleep. But I've also kind of become aware of people that they don't seem to respond too well to SMR neurofeedback. In some ways, it may actually make them more alert. And then I came across this study about PTSD and the sleep spindle. And what it said was people with PTSD, they said our results show increased spindle activity in PTSD, which positively correlates with daytime intrusive memory symptoms. So what this study is saying is that these individuals may already have an overrepresentation or extra sleep spindles. Well, I was kind of chewing on that. And then I heard Jay talk about, I think it was actually, believe it or not, on the White Noise podcast, mm-hmm. He talked about a brainwave called the lambda wave. And lambda fires in the occipital when a person is looking around, I believe it's side to side, they're scanning for threats. So I have an article here actually at the bottom. There's a new study. It shouldn't be news, but women scan for danger when walking at night. So something like that is akin to the lambda wave. You're looking around. But then on the White Noise podcast, Jay mentioned that this lambda brainwave that normally fires at the occipital, the back of the head, that sometimes it is observed at CZ where the auditory inputs are. And he says it displays as he calls it vertex activity. He said it is not a sharp vertex wave, which is what SMR is, but it is reflective of a P100, which is a fancy EEG term. It's actually ERP is what it's called. That is the kind of the cutting edge for an auditory stimulus. And so I was thinking about this PTSD study about they may already have too much sleep spindle. And then I was thinking about Jay saying that lambda may be firing where the sleep spindle normally fires, and that it even looks like it. He says the sleep spindle is a higher magnitude, or I guess that means more power at that CZ position. So I just asked Jay, I said, Jay, is there, and I was thinking about these people having side effects. And so I said, Jay, is there any chance that training SMR could, in some individuals, actually be increasing the frequency of this lambda wave, which represents hypervigilance and is seen more in a PTSD type of phenotype? And this was his response. This is his exact response. He says, the same process that makes lambda is what makes the P100 vertex wave. And to me, what that is saying is that is Jay speak for essentially, yes, possibly. Yeah. And so I thought back to this study. I'm sorry to do this roundabout, but this sleep spindle study, you know, these authors said that the PTSD sufferers may have extra sleep spindles more than normal as a form of compensation for their PTSD. And this is almost over, but basically began to think, well, if they have more sleep spindles, does that mean they're missing another sleep stage? Because sleep spindles associated with non-REM deep sleep. And sure enough, if you look it up, PTSD sufferers get less REM sleep. They have fragmented or lower REM sleep, that is dream sleep. And to just bring this all together, dream sleep is thought to be where we process threats, and it is where they believe it is instrumental, important to the process of fear memory extinction, allowing you to sort of, in plain terms, forget about the traumatic memory. Well, sleep spindles and deep sleep are correlated with remembering fine details. We know that people with PTSD, they store that. This is another recent study. They store fear memories differently. They store the fear memory as a more urgent form of a memory. And so I wonder if the authors of this study may be a little bit wrong in that this extra sleep spindle is not maybe just a compensation, but it reflects something has gone wrong in their sleep. And it they need more REM sleep, not more deep sleep. And in some individuals, it does seem to be a minority, say 15%. If they train up the sleep spindle, they may actually get more hypervigilance, more awareness of threats represented by that lambda wave. So sorry if that was a bit deep, but it was something on my mind, and the other ones will be lighter, I promise.
Well, we just did a podcast on sleep where we focused a lot on it. So this, you know, it ties into it really well.
Yeah, awesome. And obviously, Jay, you know, Jay can be the authority on that, and he's free to comment if he ever does. And so definitely still a large role for SMR neurofeedback and sleep. And the studies does say it seems to help most people. So wanted to go, let's see if we can do something a little bit more topical. Yeah. So I think this was yesterday. Drug companies have come up with a drug called, well, the article calls it Super Ozempic. And it is a drug. Well, the research name is VK2735, but the real name is, I think they call it Amcretin. And it is the same type of drug as Ozempic and Mounjaro, tirzepatide and semaglutide, Amcretin. It works on that GLP-1 receptor. But this is what it said. It said people that were on a high dose once per week lost an average of 32 pounds in, I believe they said, 13 weeks. They have the better that here. 13% of their weight in 3 months. Essentially, it's double. It's twice as effective as Ozempic and Mounjaro. And so we are just, you know, these drugs haven't been on the market that long. They're already supercharging. I actually know a UF researcher who worked on the Nature paper that is the main paper that validated these drugs for use in weight loss. They've been being used in diabetes for, I don't know, 15 years. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, the UF team among and others published a research paper in the Nature journal, the highest journal. And they showed that it's safe and effective for weight loss. But I said to them, I said, well, I heard that this new drug, Mounjaro, which is burning 30% of your weight in a year or something like that. Let's say it was 20. I can't remember the precise. Mm-hmm. He said, that's nothing. He says, in mice, we have a GLP-1 agonist. They lose half their weight in a year. So these are not the, and I'm not even saying that would be healthy. I'm just saying these drugs we're seeing are just the first drugs in that chain. That we're going to see. And there's plenty of articles of people wanting to create more weight loss drugs. And hopefully they'll get safer. You know, there's an article I have in this group. Researchers are working on a drug that it does not make you nauseous when you take it, but it still suppresses appetite. And I know we're neurofeedback, but these drugs are so popular. I thought I would, these are pretty interesting studies, I think. And it is a big issue. One other study I have here, it says, from Gizmodo, it says, most people who stop taking Wegovy or Ozempic keep the weight off, which is kind of contrary to what we've heard sometimes or what I think people think. It said 56% of patients either maintain their weight loss or continue to lose more weight, with 19% of the people in this trial doubling the amount of weight loss they had by year's end. So I want people to know it is not necessarily if they're choosing to use these drugs that if they get off, they'll lose it all. In fact, it seems like a good amount of people keep it off.
Right.
There's another study that was done recently that one of the keys to keeping it off is to exercising while doing it, just so you know. And that makes sense because, you know, this actually happens with all weight loss. I work for nutritionists, so I do get to hear about this from time to time. All weight loss comes with muscle mass loss. You cannot simply choose to lose your fat. In fact, my nutrition PhD boss showed me some research one time. Essentially, you're getting 7% of your energy needs from your body's own protein stores, meaning your body's own tissue is at any given time. Your body doesn't just say, there's not a switch you can flip and say, oh, we had a fatty meal, only turn fat now, guys. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so to spare that on any type of weight loss, including Ozempic, you resistance train, which by the way, is something that your doctor, if he's not, the medical guidelines say that resistance training is recommended for everyone. So back to this other new article. This article was a few days ago. It said the science behind Ozempic was wrong. And essentially what it says is they thought that the GLP-1 receptors in the gut are what the drug was attaching to. It's not, at least not according to these studies. It seems to be mainly working in the brain. And one of the reasons they know that is they have these receptors in your digestive system, the drug they thought it was going to attach to. Well, they did what they knocked out those receptors in mice. They bred mice or gene edited mice that don't have that receptor in their gut. Those mice did not get any weight loss from Ozempic. So it seems to be exerting all its action in the brain, which we've talked about is obesity may come from the brain. And there's other studies in here. You know, these drugs apparently do something. They help people reduce their online shopping habit. And so I feel like, obviously not directly no feedback, but to me and to researchers is kind of well known now. What these drugs are doing is working on the reward centers. And I was just hearing, Jay, we've talked about reward sensitivity all the time. I was just hearing him talk about it last night on an older video. But essentially, the anterior cingulate is part of the reward circuit. And when it misfires, you get either locked on or locked off, and it can lock onto anything. Namely, it can lock on to food in these individuals. You know, funny personal story before we get off this one. I gave up soda and caffeine for a while, and I was craving something. I was like, I need to have something. And I decided, let me try soda water. And what was crazy is I found out that, man, I could be practically as addicted to soda water, like seltzer, sparkling water, right, as I could be to unflavored, as I could be to as caffeine. And then I heard Jay say one time, he said it several times, the anterior cingulate is flexible. It can lock on to anything. It can lock on to, you know, wearing a red shirt or something, or making sure you have licorice every day. You know, and we all have these things. We know we have our habits. And sometimes it forms unhealthy ones. So Ozempic is a way to disrupt that loop, it seems like, for a lot of people.
Craving switch, right? Whether you use neurofeedback or you, you know, use Ozempic, whatever it can get to, right? No, yeah. It's great. This stuff's Jason, coming out, and Amazon's going to be pretty pissed because nobody.
Yeah, you saw that. Yeah, that was actually my boss, my client on his podcast, The Nutritionist. He said, reduces online shopping. Amazon's not going to allow this or something like that. But maybe they'll get in on the, they're trying to do pharmacy and medications. Maybe they'll get a piece of it or something.
Could Amazon be a compound pharmacy?
I don't know if they can do compound. The compound thing is interesting. So compounding is allowed so that if there's a shortage of the drug, they allow the pharmacies, local pharmacies, to kind of make the drug from raw ingredients. And what's happening right now with the Ozempic and GLP-1 drugs is pharmacies are using these, or even clinics, like doctor's offices and maybe even nurse practitioners are prescribing these drugs from their own pharmacy. And at least in our state, I think it's Novo Nordisk has sued to get those pharmacies shut down that are using that to basically be a one-stop shop for Ozempic. There might be other places because there's a shortage. I see articles all the time. Everyone wants them for weight loss. They're very expensive. And it's actually becoming a case where people who are diabetic are having trouble getting the drug and they need it so they don't die. You know, that's why they need it. And so as a result, and there's an article in the group and I'm hearing it from an MD friend, he can't get insurance to authorize the Ozempic anymore. And I know at least two people that they had to come off of it because the insurance stopped authorizing it. So now for those people, they might want to know, I didn't have a chance to find it in here, but exercise again seems to be the way to help maintain that weight loss. So if you're one of those people, but hopefully we'll have more drugs. Hopefully the costs will come down. And then neurofeedback is something you can explore now.
I mean, on the insurance side of things, why I'm scratching my head.
Lower
the insurance costs down the, you know, paying for all the other stuff at the end of the line, you know.
Exactly. And there is a study in here it's in here somewhere. Basically, Goldman Sachs did a study. Not only is it going to save the insurance company money, because conceivably, I mean, we know it lowers heart disease risk, and you know, you get a heart attack, that's a big cost to the insurance company.
Yeah.
But there's a study by Goldman Sachs that came out in the last week or so, and it's probably in this group. They found that Ozempic conceivably add like 1.7% to the national GDP, because they said because of the amount of productivity lost when people miss work. So basically, we know that there's I think it's actually just up here, but we know that people who have extra weight, they tend to get sick more. Specifically, they get COVID more. You know, one of the first markers for COVID risk we heard about was high blood pressure. But I saw a different article that said that the highest marker of COVID risk was actually your weight. And high blood pressure and high weight can be correlated to that. So yeah, so this is not only good for insurance companies, it could be good for the whole economy. Now, it seems to be one of the reasons they're denying people is they know that their diabetic patients need it more. I don't have an article right in front of me saying that, but that was sort of the thought process of the doctor I was speaking to. Yeah. Oh, and I'll tell you, for people that are on the drug, you know, this idea, if you stop taking it, the weight comes back. That was an interesting anecdote. An MD friend told me about a weight loss MD that he knows, that she likes to have you be on the drug for 1 year after you reach your target weight, because she believes that that will reset your set point. You've heard about how people have a weight they kind of naturally want to gravitate to. I've certainly kind of felt that way before. And that may be a lot of things to the brain, could be microbiome, et cetera, because that all changes when you lose weight. But she likes to get people on it for like an extra year. Seems like that's hard to do, though, with these insurances not approving or insurers not approving. But just to finish, these are just kind of some shockers, kind of interesting. I haven't fully teased out what this means. But I was listening to a psychiatrist this week on YouTube. He said, and I looked it up, he said, children born to obese women with diabetes were more than four times as likely to be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. So I looked that up. This is a Johns Hopkins study. Very interesting. So these drugs, again, could be having beneficial effects, not just for the typical things we think of. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been hearing that autism has been going up for years now. We've been hearing, and we know that obesity has been going up for years now. Conceivably, there's a connection. I have kind of some theories, but maybe we'll talk about that later. And I wanted to say, here was an article from the New York Times. They promoted body positivity, then they lost weight. And these are influencers and their fans. They had got backlash from their fans. How dare you lose weight? You told me, you know, body, any weight, you know, healthy weight is more important than any weight. Healthy at any size.
Right.
Well, the thing about that is I post two studies here, one of them very recent. A new study in the journal Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolism says that people with metabolically healthy obesity, that is, they don't show things like high blood pressure and high blood sugar, they are still 1.5 times more likely to develop diabetes than normal weight individuals, and people with no known complications still had a 50% higher risk for heart disease. So this is, you know, this is sort of an answer. This is not to say we don't be sensitive. We know, since we talk about the brain, we know that addiction is a compulsion. It's not just a choice, and eating and anything like that. So we're sensitive to that. But we also know that ultimately, it just sort of makes sense that if you have less weight, you're less load on your body. And so these drugs, hopefully, and other things, this won't be the last one, will help. So wanted to discuss that. There's an app that you guys could try, this that came out. It's called Eat This, Not That, I think it's called. But basically, one last thing on Eat Right Now is the name of the app. And they say that in 10 or 15 times of somebody opening their app and noticing that they're overeating, I think they ask you some questions, you know, how full do you feel? People start to shift their behaviors, and they believe it works through the principle of mindfulness. So if you were looking for an app, you're not ready for Ozempic, maybe this app called Eat Right Now is right for you. That was kind of the last thing I had on the, well, one more thing real quick. Vagus, there's a new study, very recent. Vagus nerve stimulators may work in obesity. And I haven't quite investigated those. Maybe Jay can talk about those sometime. I'd love to hear what he says. But they may help people with their obesity problem too. And you can get them nowadays. You can get vagus nerve stimulators over the counter and you do them under your ear. Maybe there's a couple other places. But they seem to, the vagus nerve is associated with the parasympathetic rest and digest reflex. So they seem to put you in a state where you're not as hungry, hopefully. A calm state. I guess stress and overeating go hand in hand. So that was sort of the last on the round topic of Ozempic. And well, I wanted to go rapid fire since we started a little later here.
Yeah.
My bad on that. There was recent research this month, past couple weeks, that COVID is a brain injury. And it's like to anyone in the EEG community, it's kind of like, duh, you know, like we know this. We've known this for 4 years. You know, I've been seeing specifically, they say there's upregulated inflammatory markers and other proteins that are not supposed to be in the blood that reflect brain injury in COVID. They also say it reflects damage to the blood vessels. But, you know, I mean, I've heard on your podcast years ago, probably at this point, you know, the most common EEG pattern seen in COVID, I think, is elevated delta, maybe theta. It's slow waves in the front of the brain. Those seem to reflect ischemia, I think, and basically circulation is not as good. I may have that wrong. Not the expert on this. This is from memory. But basically, it's a little frustrating, but I guess they do catch up eventually is the idea here. And I will say I did discover some interesting things about COVID that started making me think about other syndromes like chronic pain. Actually, in that video, they mentioned CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, they seem to share a similar EEG pattern with long COVID or COVID. And what I found is, interestingly, women under 50 were five times more likely to develop post-COVID symptoms. And, you know, that's sobering. And it seems like maybe clinicians, they have to have seen this, I feel. But it's interesting to know that, unfortunately, it may affect women more. And if you are a woman and you are having symptoms since having had COVID, maybe look at neurofeedback. The other thing I want to say is my MD friend mentioned to me, post-viral syndromes, which is where you got sick and you're still sick months later, it's not just COVID. He said it may even be more common to other viruses. And there is a disease, an article recently that said that basically long flu is probably more likely than long COVID. It's just we've had all these COVID cases all at once because there was no immunity. So looking into neurofeedback, if you have some of those viral issues that remain. The other thing is that was interesting to me is obviously it says the long COVID is more five times more likely among women below 50. That reminded me that there's a study I put in here. Fibromyalgia, women make up about 91% of fibromyalgia chronic fatigue patients. 91% of chronic fatigue patients are women. And again, if you have these types of symptoms, an EEG could be a good idea to find out if you have the pattern that we're talking about. This is an interesting one on loneliness. And I guess I'm kind of excited to get to some of these, so I'll jump into it. But basically, the article is we don't hang out. And what they said is, well, there were a few shockers. Boys and girls 15 to 19 are reducing their weekly hangouts by 3 hours a week. A lot of this, maybe because they're more extroverted to begin with, women are more extroverted on average, is happening with girls. They said the group with the largest increase in phone use are 12th grade girls. The other thing they said is the average woman with a pet now spends more time actively engaged with her pet than she spends hanging out face to face. And so it feels like it's interesting. These are all, if you notice, these are all single men in this photo from the Atlantic of hanging out by themselves. It seems like we have a little bit of a, well, not a little bit. And the idea is obviously that we're spending time on phones. You know, Jonathan Haidt is a, he used to be at Harvard. I think he might be New York University, but he talks a lot about how Gen Z is not hanging out. We have a problem with phones, problem with face-to-face. Men tend to be on their video games. The young boys tend to be on their video games. Women tend to, and YouTube, women tend to spend more time on social media. So there's a lot going on there. We can probably talk about Gen Z at some point. But I thought it was worth it. It was kind of a shocking, kind of some of the articles were shocking to me. And so wanted to get into that. But I will tell you that men seem to be, I mean, we all know. So there's research that men speak less to begin with. They speak less as they age. You know, the comedian John Mulaney, he says, my dad doesn't have friends. He says, don't laugh. Your dad doesn't have friends either. He says, all your dad's friends are your mom's friends' husbands. And I thought to myself, you know, that feels kind of right. And having been in relationships, that feels kind of right. And interestingly, Jay has talked about the brainwave called mu rhythm. Mu rhythm reflects the ability to empathize. Well, it reflects a turned off frontal lobe, but the frontal lobe contains, that's where our famous mirror neurons are that allow us to turn on empathy, putting ourselves in another shoes. That's why they're called mirror neurons. To do what they're doing is really the first reason they're there, to emulate. And that allow, they allow us though, to get into somebody's headspace. Well, men have more mu rhythm on average, and that seems to turn off that frontal lobe. And that seems to turn off that empathy. It's probably not a coincidence that men are known as a little bit less nurturing, empathetic, and they have more of that mu rhythm. So, and interestingly, you know, I heard there's a clinician you've had on, Joshua Moore, very nice, extremely helpful clinician that I talk to on Facebook all the time. And he said he noticed during the pandemic that the incidence of seeing mu rhythm in the EEGs that he was doing went way up. I mean, Jay says that it seems to be, this is from memory from a while back, but I think he said it's in about 15% of normal EEGs. Josh Moore thinks he says he sees it in about half or more at this point, which makes sense because mu rhythm only goes away when you see biological motion. It doesn't go away from watching, they've literally done studies like watching a robot or a mannequin do stuff. It doesn't go away. You can't empathize with that, at least not without training. Well, what are we doing since the pandemic? More work from home, less going out. You're looking at words on a computer screen, not other people. And I'm even thinking, and this is again, just speculation. Why do we get a sense that certain people in the sciences or technology are maybe not as touchy-feely as some others? You know, as a nurse who's working, maybe it's because they're not working with people face-to-face. As somebody like a teacher or nurse saying 50 faces a day, 100 faces, you know. So anyway, a lot of interesting stuff there. That's not just it's not just a cute story about phones. I don't think it might be a story about technology and gender differences and our culture. You know, men are discouraged. There's a research. One last thing on men. Yeah. There's a researcher that has been doing an annual survey of the state of male friendship. He's a psychology academic, and he said when he first started doing it in the 70s, he had to convince his academic friends that it was not a survey on homosexuality, because when people said it was a survey about male friendship, they just assumed, you know,
right.
There are people, researchers that have said friendship itself is seen as effeminate on some level. So anyway, and what do we think of as, I'm thinking of the strong silent type and the lone gunman in the Western. So anyway, those are men's Dirty Harry. Long story short, one more thing I wanted to get in at least, I found the study where it comes from, the idea that you need, I said, I think 2.5, I think that's figure make, but it's called the STAR-D study on depression. People in the study, so basically 50% of people in this study, it's one of the biggest studies ever done on antidepressant use and depression. 50% of the people in the study needed to try two medications to have remission. I can't remember if they said response or remission, but basically to improve at least. But even trying four medications, they were only able to help or get improvement in 70% of patients. So I thought that was interesting. There is an article here about the STAR-D trial. There's several here about it. And basically, this is a chart that was posted, very interesting chart. Jay Gaddis posted this, that Amen clinic clinician I meant to mention. It shows, it compares all sorts of different treatments from a British Medical Journal study for treating depression. And basically they said that dance, believe it or not, is the best thing you can do for depression. After that, you had walking and yoga and CBT and exercise plus SSRI. SSRIs alone are way down here, you know? Now I did have an MD friend look at this. One caveat, he says, The dance had the fewest amount of studies. This was a meta study, review of studies, had the fewest amount of studies and only had 107 subjects. But he did notice that all these error bars, these are the confidence intervals, they kind of all overlap. They kind of all cluster at 50%. If you look at these values here, let's see, between 40 and 50%. I thought that was interesting. I mentioned this chart last time. Yes, this is a chart that was shared at Jay's conference by Martine Arns, and it shows treatment responses to different depression therapies like antidepressants and ketamine and TMS and psychotherapy. He noticed, he thought it was funny too. He said, they all kind of cluster around 50%. We know I might be getting some of this math wrong, but in a lot of these studies, 50% of people respond to placebo. So kind of makes you wonder. I think a lot of these treatments are doing real things. And I know I can feel improvement from doing walking, jogging, dancing, et cetera. But it did make me think, you know, neurofeedback, a lot of studies are showing not 50% of people respond, but say 80%, you know? So we might be beating, you know, we maybe don't, I don't know if we have a study as large as this one or a meta study as large as this one, but we might be beating all these treatments hands down by the time they do all the research. So maybe one day we'll be able to prove that even to the non-believers or the hard to
convince. More data.
Yeah, it feels like, that. I know Jay is like, I'll believe it when I see it. Sounds like I'll see it when I believe it sometimes. Yeah, and yeah. I heard one time recently, people that want to understand you, it doesn't matter how you say it. People that don't want to understand you, it won't matter how you say it. So anyway, we right. know that what we're doing, you know, you only need to see so many transformations before you're a believer. Here's a big study in time, recent study. This was a 2019 review article. You know, you always hear CBT is the most evidence-backed therapy. We know the reviews seem to say it helps about half of people. Again, 50%. And this study was a review of multiple evidence-backed therapies. CBT is the most evidence-backed. It's not the only evidence-backed. There's evidence for other therapies, but they still said that the studies had low and poor quality data for a lot of these studies. So we need to do better. This is not a call to stop using therapy. One of the things they say is, you know, you need to match the therapy and the practitioner to the person. One of the things I did like to hear in this article, this is a Time Magazine article, remember, they shared a study and the name of the study is Psychiatric Diagnosis Scientifically Meaningless. And what it is about is the DSM. It goes on to say the DSM is not a logical scientific construct because 40% of the symptoms overlap. So you might have low energy. You might have that in depression, or you might have it in bipolar, or, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know. But, or you might have it in something else, delusion, et cetera. So which one does that mean you have? And if you go to a different therapist, are you going to get a diagnosis, different psychiatrist? Probably you will. I mean, probably we have people right. that listen that have seen that. Jay and you, I know, always talk about, well, what about a test? Let's do a test. The symptom is not, it's Jay. I think he used the phrase. He said the scan and the symptoms are both pieces of the presentation that really tell you what's going on. So we want to know what's going on for real. We don't want to settle for 50%.
Yeah.
Like right. some of these treatments do. Many of your listeners, and if you want to keep going, we can, but I'll use this one. Yeah. Many of your listeners may have listened to I believe she's like a sex and relationship therapist named Esther Perel. Very great speaker, interesting to listen to. Her main message seems to be, it takes a village. You know, we are now expecting one partner to do things that before a whole community of people, you know, would do for us. We talked about how men have fewer friends, but probably I think the studies are showing women have, unfortunately, fewer friends these days too. So, but the interesting part of this article, this is a conversation with her and a man who is, it says he's 40 and he's never had a long-term relationship. And I actually have some friends, not relationship, but they've told me, you know, I've never been in love. And so I was reading this article. I remembered there is a sex and love researcher, academic. Her name is Pia Melody. She is a nurse practitioner, PhD, who works in love and sex addiction clinics. And what she talks about is, before I tell you this article, what she talks about is the typical, many of your viewers have heard of attachment theory. I notice we talk about the need to attach in childhood. We don't talk about the attachment styles as much. There's a little bit, they name them different depending on the researcher, but there is a picture of a person called the love avoidant. And the love avoidant is not just a person who doesn't date. Frequently, they do date. They're kind of an interesting person. They're frequently in relationship. What P.M. Melody says is this: the most common picture of a love avoidant person is a child who has one parent who is addicted to sex, drugs, or alcohol, or is a workaholic, otherwise unavailable. She says, though, the remaining parent is left to deal with that, and they tend to rely on their child emotionally in a process called parentification. She said, interestingly, so that makes the child very good at fulfilling needs, you know, helping mom feel better. Mom, you're great. I don't want to belittle people suffering by doing too much of a character. This is what I'm understanding.
Yeah.
But the problem is they're good at fulfilling needs, but that causes them, the parent over-relying on them, causes them to associate love with suffocation and obligation. But they get their identity from fulfilling needs. So as a consequence, ironically, they are frequently in relationship. The classic picture of a love avoidant is sort of the male player. They're sometimes called dismissive avoidance or anxious ambivalent avoidant, I believe is the term. But they're frequently in relationships. They tend to be charismatic, and they're very good at fulfilling needs. In women, it tends to produce as a serial monogamous. So often in relationship, but they avoid intimacy. So they try to maintain independence or pseudo-independence in their relationship. And this is why there's this new name in social media going around called situationship. We're not in a relationship where I can count on them. We're in a relationship where sort of when the stars are right, they want to hang out and they need me. Well, anyway, what this guy's letter says is it's the classic presentation. When women get too close or when they express love to him, he distances himself. And what he says is, she says, tell me about your background, Esther Perel, in this interview. He says, well, my dad, my mom caught him with another woman and he left. He just left the picture abruptly. And he said, I was very mad at my dad for leaving. And he said, but I was left. My mom did not take it well. And he says, not only that, even before that, my dad had been cheating all along. And before that, she was saying things to me like, your father's not doing well again. I just don't know what I'm going to do with your father. That over-relying, relying on the child emotionally. And he says, this person was a conscious, he's self-aware. He said, I resented my mom for not being able to take it. So as a result in adulthood, he likes to be in relationship. And he actually says he pursues people. But when he finally wins them, he spurns them or he removes affection from them. And he's realized that it's affecting his life. Interestingly, and maybe this would help somebody that's out there, what Esther Perel says, she says, have you told any of your exes this story, you know, why this happened to you? And he said, no. And she said, I think you should try. And he said, okay, I think she might be more receptive than you think. And so I'll be interested if there's a part two. She has a great podcast called Where Do We Begin? On relationships of all kinds, modern relationships. So anyway, attachment theory is kind of a deep love for me. It's one of my favorite psychological theories. So thank you for letting me share it. I kind of feel, attachment theory is not just about how you treat your spouse. You know, people who are avoidant, they tend to be the kind of people, they don't show up unless you call them, you know, right, they don't right. stop by to see just how you're doing, you know, and maybe they tend to be a little bit less validating in the research. They tend to be a little bit less complimentary or saying thank you and sorry. Those are actual studies. Whereas an anxious person, even in friendship, they tend to be needier, you know, you didn't call, you know, hey, would you hang out with me? Would you go to the store with me? I'm thinking of random, and I relate to that to some degree. So, these things are more powerful than just our love interest. And it's not just childhood it affects us. It's not just with trauma. It's affecting, in my opinion, at least I believe, that our early childhood attachments can affect the rest of our lives. Fortunately, and when I can talk about attachment for more of an episode, what I'll get into is I have a theory, and I think I've seen now that people can help resolve their attachment style if they do what Jay advocates, which is clearing the EEG. And so of the elevated or excess brainwaves often that are described in his phenotypes. And so I'll just tease that for one day when we can talk about it. And I also publish all this on my Facebook at facebook.com/ Tony O. Ramos.
Tony O. Ramos right here.
Awesome.
All right, Anthony Ramos.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks to you too, Pete. We appreciate
have
it.
Have a great weekend, buddy.
You too. Have a good one.
All right.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration into polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.